Thank you for listening to this Last Blast podcast by The Intercooler. Now, before we get started, I just want to take a moment to thank Footman James for sponsoring Last Blast. As you know, at The Intercooler, we only partner with like-minded organisations, with companies that we think really understand what it means to be a car enthusiast. Footman James fit into that perfectly. I know this because when talking to them before making this recording, they said to me, please don't talk about car insurance, which I think says a lot. So instead, I'm just going to give you a couple of reasons why Footman James is different to other car insurance companies. Coffee and chrome, for one thing. That's Footman James' regular car meet. It's free to attend once you're registered, and it's where hundreds, if not a thousand, car enthusiasts get together with their classics to enjoy and share their passion for cars. Footman James also publishes its indicator report. It's a thorough analysis and a detailed report into the state of classic car ownership in this country. The point is to promote and safeguard the future of classic cars in the UK. So there you go, two good reasons why Footman James is different to other car insurance companies. So thank you, Footman James. Go and visit footmanjames.co.uk. You're listening to the Last Blast podcast by The Intercooler. This week, Andrew Frankel talks to Dr. Jonathan Palmer.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Last Blast podcast. My guest this week will need no introduction to any of you. It is none other than Dr. Jonathan Palmer, veteran of 83 Grand Prix.
Yep.
We'll talk lots about sports cars because I think people, when people think of you, they think about Formula One. But you did a lot of work in sports cars as well, didn't you?
Yes, I did. At the time I was doing Formula One, between which was my first Grand Prix, was actually the Grand Prix of Europe in 1985, when I just won the Formula 2 championship. Yeah. And I was the test driver for the Williams team. Yeah. I was their first ever test driver for Frank and Patrick Head, 82-83. And Frank very kindly said, which is, will never happen today, but Frank very kindly said, that look, we'll run a third car for you at the Grand Prix of Europe at Brands Hatch. And they had Keke Rosberg and Jacques Lafitte as the regular drivers, and they ran a third car for me. So that was my first ever Grand Prix back in 83. And then in 84, that was a one-off. I joined Ram and for the first of 6 years. But, you know, at that time in the 80s, when I was really Formula One racing, many of us were driving sports cars at the same time. Yeah. And I think that was one of the reasons why this was the era of Group C, which was a hugely successful era of sports cars. And the great thing was with Group C is that you had the manufacturers there, like Porsche and Lancia, but you also had loads of privateers. The privateers could compete on a reasonable basis against the factory teams. Yeah. You know, the factory teams would generally be out in front, but only took a little bit of a hiccup from them, and a privateer team would be out there taking the reward. So, you know, the people like, you know, me, I'm driving essentially for Richard Lloyd in the infamous Canon Porsche 956.
Oh, beautiful. One of beautiful my favourite liveries.
Yeah, exactly. It really is. But, you know, other drivers that I was racing in Formula One with, I reckon half the field was in sports cars. We had, you know, like, obviously Martin Brundle did it, Stefan Beloff, Derek Warwick, Cheever, Bootsen, Farby, Alberto, Patrese, Jochen Mass. I mean, it was, and I think that made a big difference to the success of international sports car racing. Imagine today.
Yeah.
And of course, the other thing is then, my last year of Formula One in 1989, there were 38 cars trying to qualify.
Jeez.
Nearly twice as many cars as go to a Grand Prix now.
Okay.
So when you talk about half the, in 84, maybe it was 34, but it wasn't 26 or something. So when we talk about half the field driving sports cars, you're talking at least 15 drivers, 15 F1 drivers.
Yeah.
In sports cars.
In any given sports car race.
Yeah.
And probably more at Le Mans.
And more at Le Mans, exactly. Yeah. And that definitely gave it a lot more appeal. The grids were big. You know, 1,000-kilometer races had big grids, big sponsors.
Yeah.
It was quite a heyday. It probably might have been the heyday of sports car racing, actually.
Okay. So before we get going with any of this, because I could talk for hours, and we need to be reasonably sensible with the time, We always ask our guests for three things to start off with. What were your, so it's first car, first race, first crash. So what was your the first car that you could genuinely call your own?
Well, my first car that I could genuinely call my own was, I'll give you kind of two answers here, Andrew. The first one was a Morris Minor van that my father bought for me when I was 13, yeah. 14. We used to live in a, we had a house down in Sussex, a village called Chailey, not far from Lewes, where it was a modest sized, well, reasonable sized house, six bedroom house that my mother had converted to a nursing home to try and, actually it's an interesting story, she converted to a nursing home so my parents, my father was a GP, could educate us privately. And my brother and I lived in a caravan in the backyard for 3 years while she got the nursing home going.
How was the caravan?
Caravan was fine. We thought it was great, you know, away from nagging parents and all of that.
Yeah.
But she had this. So we had this paddock at the back of the in front of the garden, a couple of acre paddock, and great place to learn to drive.
Yeah.
And drift around. So my father bought me this Morris Minor van. And I very soon thought it looked a bit cooler by chopping the back off with the tin snip, so I made it into a pickup. That was the first bit of modification. And I then go out and thrash this Morris Minor van. Of course, it's perfect thing to learn in, front engine, rear wheel drive.
Yeah.
So I sort of perfect opposite locking drifts around in the paddock, which was great fun, apart from a couple of problems. One was that my mother would quite unreasonably end up shrieking from an upstairs window because I was making too much racket and disturbing her patients in the nursing home. So that was a regular, and of course, I always, whenever an exhaust part fell off, I never bothered to replace it. It always sounded a lot cooler,
yeah.
With less exhaust on it.
Yeah.
So this rorty sort of, albeit, I don't know, what did it have, 48 horsepower or something? Morris Minor van.
Yes.
Sideways at the bottom of poor patients' beds, bedrooms, didn't go down too well. But the other thing is that because it threw a little bit of woodland and a bit of hedging, I'd occasionally go off and go into the hedge and into the bushes, and inevitably that meant that some branch would go through the radiator and of the Morris Minor, and my father got pretty fed up with going to the scrapyard to pick up more radiators for Morris Minor 1000s, and so after he put the fourth one on, he then said that's it. So then I found a very interesting fact. And that is that if you run a Morris Minor with no water in it whatsoever, it will run for 11 minutes before the engine seizes. So I would have 8 minutes of playtime,
yeah.
And I would then turn it off with it going ping, ping, ping when I stopped. And it would all cool down, and because they were pretty rugged old engines.
It'd be fine.
Give it another 24 hours, you fire it up again, you've got another 8 minutes of
world's
fun.
First so that air-cooled Morris Minor.
Exactly. So that was my first kind of car, but my first road car was when I was 17. It was a Ford Anglia. You'll probably remember the, was it 105E or the one later? The one with the back wrongly facing rear window.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had a 1200 Super that was actually, it was a kind of adopted grandfather's car, and he did about 13,000 miles in 7 years, and then my father bought it for £250 and gave it to me when I was 17, which was lovely. Not that I looked after it as well as I should have done. So that was really my first proper road car. Yes. Ford Anglia, okay. 1200 Super.
Lovely. You can choose whether to go first race or first crash next, because some people, their first crash was in their first race.
Well, let's go first crash next, because that follows on quite well from the first car, this, which is clearly the Ford Anglia. And that's that, I was at school, at Brighton College, and I had another friend there in Brighton who was keen on his cars. He had a Hillman Imp, and we joined the Brighton Hove Motor Club, and they used to meet at a place called Withdean Stadium down in Brighton. So we'd go along there, these two young 17-year-olds, I guess we'd go and sort of sup on our orange juices or something whilst people were having their pints, and like motor clubs used to be. And anyway, after the meetings, everybody would clear off and leave the car park. But this was a great big gravel car park, so it's the perfect place for handbrake turns.
Yeah.
However, on one particular occasion, I was perfecting the reverse flip, flat out in reverse, flicking the wheel around and spinning it around and going off forwards. Only problem is the gravel rather built up, and this top-heavy Ford Anglia fell over.
Blimey.
At night, and I rolled it, basically. I rolled it in the car park at night. And my mate, Alan Timpany, who was in his imp, realised something was wrong when the two headlights in his mirror was one above the other, not one beside the other. And a very embarrassed JP climbed out of the door, which was now a car on its side, to be surrounded by, and very rapidly, having heard the commotion, a load of the old motor club regulars who clearly thought I had absolutely zero potential as a driver in my life.
So, well, indeed.
So that was my... I put the thing back on its wheels, drove it back home, and came up with the usual cock and bull story to my father about how some fox jumped out of the road
usual
and we
story,
had to
yeah.
swerve, you know, and... Yeah. And the kind of look from him, you know, said it all, really, but...
He knew. Right, first race.
First race was at Thruxton in 1976, when I was 18 years old, from when I left school, went to Guy's Hospital as a medical student.
Yeah.
And I was desperate to start racing somehow. I really didn't have any... You know, my father didn't race. He was... Through my own interest in motor racing, he became, he was a GP. He became a circuit doctor for the BARC. He actually ended up as the chief medical officer for BARC. And so I persuaded him to come along or go and do medic work at races so I could go and watch club mm-hmm. racing. So I went to Guy's and I found in this house that I rented a room of in Honor Oak Park, South East London, there was a chap who just qualified as a dentist. I, therefore, 5 years older than me, you know, I was just a first year medical student.
Yeah.
And I was desperate to try and find something to start racing with. And this chap had just qualified as a dentist and he got a Jensen Healey. So I thought, right, well, here's someone who's qualified, he's loaded,
yeah.
and he's a car enthusiast.
Yeah.
So I persuaded the chap, his name is Dave Mercer, still a good friend. So I said, look, we need to, you know, let's go racing. We can go racing. I got him enthused to go motor racing. I found in Cars and Car Conversions magazine that you'll remember.
I do, Triple C.
The Triple C, indeed. Do you have Terry Grimwood there? I don't know if he's still around, but probably not. But I found the cheapest car because that was all I could afford.
Yeah.
It was a Frog Eye Sprite for sale for £325 down in Thanet, down in Kent. I went down to see it and I knew I was going to buy it because it was the only thing that was vaguely affordable.
Yeah.
I flogged my push bike, school built go car, everything I possessed to raise £162 for my half share.
Yeah.
Dave bought the other half share. And Julie turned up at Thruxton with this car.
And this was a standard road car.
No, it was modified. It actually quite a nice little engine. Actually, it had a you know, the Frog Eye Sprites originally, I think it's 948 cc's, and it was 1098, and then it became the, you know, different shape and slightly updated 1300s. But mine was actually a 1071. Now this is going to sound a bit geeky, but. One of the things that they did is, people did, is put the Mini Cooper S 1071 engine. You cut off the taper on the crank that was, you needed for the front wheel drive for that installation with the drop gears, and you'd weld on a flange, and then you put it transversely, and you'd use the 1071 engine. It's a lovely little engine that would rev to about 9,000 revs.
Yeah.
And that's what this thing had. The only problem was it didn't have any oil pressure or anything else, so the thing blew up pretty quickly. But anyway, my first race was at Thruxton. I think I didn't know anything about racing cars. And it was on old CR65 tyres.
Oh, blimey.
And it was wet. And I was at the back of the field. And I slithered around. I probably finished, I don't know, maybe there was a field of 20 cars. I want to look at the old result sheets. I might have it somewhere. And I was probably, if not last, towards the back.
Yeah.
But having zero grip. And anyway, so... That was the start of a very long learning curve that ended up, evolving the car and trying to maintain it on a student grant was quite a challenge.
But was it as great as you'd expected it to be? Was racing everything? Because obviously you'd spent a long time thinking about racing and now you're actually doing it. Did it actually live up to your expectations?
I wouldn't say it was... It was kind of, you know, it was great in a way, but grim in another, in that it was great because I was doing something and totally absorbed in it that was all I cared about in life. And my whole world was really, the vast majority of my world was centered around how I was going to do better,
yeah,
and how the car was going to need to improve and what I could do to achieve it, be it in ideas, finding the funds to do it, whatever.
Yeah.
I was on a mission to try and do better. At the same time, you know, try and keep the medical school tolerably happy as a student.
Yeah.
But I mean, the learning curve was massive.
Yeah.
You know, the thing, the first time I went out, the thing put a rod through the side. I never bought a new tyre for the first 3 years of my motor racing career. It was just second-hand tyres. There used to be a guy called Ron Livingston at Smalldole near Gatwick who had a barn full of old Firestone and Goodyear and Dunlop tyres. And even when I had my Marcus the next year, if the thing had understeer, I used to go and buy a bigger front tyre. And if it had oversteer, I'd buy a bigger rear tyre. You know, it just went on like that. And, you know, I didn't know how to track a car. You know, one time in the second year with my Marcus 3 litre, I thought I'd better track this up. So I got a couple of bits of 4x3 timber and put them in against the front wheels and just squinted at them from the front of the car, and it looked reasonably parallel. So I thought that'll do. Now that was as far as tracking went. But you know, one day I should write a book about it, which nobody will read, but possibly my kids. But it was a hell of a learning curve. So you know, it wasn't like jumping in a competitive race car and getting the thrill of driving race car.
Yeah.
Most of my first 3 years of racing was largely all about making pig's ears of a cars go better somehow. And number one, reliably.
Yeah.
Number two, have some brakes. And trying to get a result out of it. The first proper racing car I ever drove was a Formula Ford in my fourth year of racing. And suddenly I was driving a car that was designed for the job.
Yeah.
But actually it was reliable. It didn't take biceps of Popeye to steer.
Yeah.
The brake pedal did stay firm. And
yeah,
you could actually enjoy going racing rather than just being focused on trying to make this car more suitable for the job.
Yeah. Okay. So one of the things we do with everybody who comes on this podcast is we ask them to name their 6 favourite cars. And then at the end of the podcast, you're going to tell us which one you'd take for your last ever drive. But we'll get there later on. First, what's the first car? And these can be cars that you've owned or you've driven or you've raced or you've just admired from afar.
Right. Well, I've thought about this a bit, obviously, because you did say yesterday that this is what you wanted to know.
Yeah.
The first car on my list is a Capri 3 litre.
Right.
And this is sort of 72, 73.
So a Mark 1?
A Mark 1.
Yeah.
And a Mark 1 facelift. And this is a car that I put on the list because I didn't drive, well, I did drive a little bit actually, but I was, I don't know how old I would have been, 15, 16 or 15 or something at the time, 14, 15. But this was a car that my father had. And my father used to quite like his cars, but I was one of these sort of kids that loved cars even more than, and I'd encourage my father. I'd be pretty much telling my father what he should be buying next. As a 10-year-old, I was an avid, actually in fact, motor more than auto car reader. And I can, to my slight embarrassment, I can even remember now 0 to 50 times. It wasn't 60 in those days.
Because
I
couldn't get
50.
There. Yeah.
0 to 50 times of all of these cars.
Yeah.
You know, I had this sort of encyclopedic knowledge of all this. He started off with Mark 1 Cortina 1500 GT and then a Mark 2 Lotus Cortina.
Wow.
And then he got a bit strapped for cash and we went to an Escort 1300. But then he actually, and I was, you know, the Capri was the car that, particularly with the V6 3 litre, I mean, this was, and I think what's really interesting is that this was such an aspirational car. It was for me and I was for him. And I can remember the day the new Capri 3 litre arrived. It came in the drive. Now the original Mark 1 Capri, the V6s had I think 128 horsepower, and then they had another 10 horsepower and they breathed a bit better from 138.
Yeah.
But what's really interesting is that, I mean, I can remember this thing would reach 70 miles an hour in second gear. That was a big deal in those days.
Yeah.
Its top speed from motor, I just happen to remember now, was 122. That's what they do. But you know what's really interesting is that these are sort of numbers. I mean, 138 horsepower, you know, a mid-range Focus would have that or
something.
Absolutely,
yeah.
But it is all about, it's all about context, really, and our perception on how good we think cars are. And I think in a way, they were great. That was a great era, because I, my father, and other people were all hugely impressed with the Capri 3 litre. I mean, not everybody, don't get me wrong. I mean, if we were wealthier, then you'd be looking at E-types and Porsches.
Yeah.
But for modest, you know, modest levels of financial means, that was, I mean, that's where Ford really hit it off. They really understood that market. The market for cars played into that beautifully, and the fast Ford thing was fantastic. Mm. And people aspired to that, got excited about it, it gave them a lot of pleasure. And the Capri that ranged from, you had this, as you'll remember, the sort of UK Mustang-y type concept, from a 1300 with no doubt 70 horsepower.
Couldn't get out of its own way.
Couldn't get out of its own way. Yeah. To a 1600, a 2 litre V4, and a 3 litre V6.
Yeah.
And so it was really exciting. It was an exciting car. It was exciting to be driven in, exciting to drive, to own. For my father, and it gives a lot of pleasure. And I think it's one of the things that I think now I look forward, well, I say I look forward, wrong word, looking forward to the future. I mean, clearly people haven't, people aren't going to get this sort of pleasure in the future. You know, our whole world of the appeal of cars for enthusiasts has been so much based, underpinned around the number of cylinders and cubic capacity. And whether it's the Capri, is that an example, or whether it's a BMW 520, 530, 535, our perception and excitement and aspiration is driven by the core value of a car being its cylinders, number of cylinders, and its capacity. That's going to go. With electric cars, we've just at a sweat removed a massive amount of a source of appeal for a car that's been there for a century. But anyway, so that's a bit why I've sort of chucked the Capri into that, really.
Okay. So before we start on the racing career, you obviously had this other career beforehand. Did you, when you were growing up, did you always want to be a racing driver but went down the road of medicine because that didn't seem a realistic possibility to you? Or I'm just wondering why you became a doctor rather than pursuing your dream of becoming a racing driver.
I didn't really have a dream of becoming a racing driver.
But you loved
cars. I didn't
cars.
Know enough about it. I remember reading, I remember reading in Motor one time an expression that I firmly remember and really resonated with me was, I was a big fan of rallying. Roger Clark, too. I was a massive Roger Clark fan in rallying. And I remember an interview with Motor with Roger Clark when he was asked about why doesn't he want to go Formula One driving and go Formula One. And he said, well, who would want to be running around with a 45-gallon fuel tank strapped to your ass? which was an interesting comment at the time, actually, in the early 70s. Formula One and actually even Formula 3 and motor racing was not a world I knew at all.
Yeah.
And I knew the bottom little ends of it. I got to know the little bottom ends of it as a teenager with club racing. But I thought I had no idea. I mean, my father knew someone who knew someone who eventually I met and see Graham Hill once when I was sort of 17 or something. But I mean, he would have seen lots of people and, but I had no knowledge. So, but also I was sensible enough to know that I hadn't a clue whether I got the ability to be a Formula One driver or got the means, the nous to get there. All I knew is that I wanted to have a go and start somewhere.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I certainly didn't consider as a teenager that, or even when I was 17, 18, that I had the ability or the means to be a race driver, a professional race driver. I knew what life was like. I wanted to go racing. I knew what life was like as a GP. My father was one. And he was sort of home-based. I mean, they used to work long hours, but nevertheless, he was still kind of home-based, a bit of flexibility on what you did. And I thought, well, it's the devil I know, really, if you like.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking about going into engineering, but probably a good thing I didn't. So I did medicine because it was something I knew. It was something I knew my father would be quite pleased if I did. And I probably, it's so hard in life, it is next to impossible in life to really know the reality of what's out, what a, any given career is going to look like.
Yeah.
When you're 15, 16, you just don't know.
Of course not.
The only what you do know is what your dad did,
yeah,
and maybe what a few of his friends did and how that's like, but that's about it. So yeah. Otherwise you kind of, so that's why I did medicine. And then, so I qualified, and but as I was medical student at Guy's, I was doing mod sports, sports car. So the Sprite, 2 years of the Marcus, and then Formula Ford, and that clearly was my passion.
Yeah.
I loved it, and I was doing well and better and better. And when I qualified, I worked for a year as a junior doctor at hospitals in Sussex, Brighton and Cookfield, racing Formula Ford, and I thought, God, and I was front running. But, you know, I was working, shit, I was working 100 hours, 120 hours as a doctor as well. You know, I'd be racing at Alton Park on a Sunday, or actually Saturday would be, because I wouldn't be on a Sunday. And I might be on that weekend. So I'd
so be clocking on for the night shift.
So I'd be clocking, so I'd be working Friday, I'd work Friday evening, I'd get someone to cover for me from midnight Friday or something, I'd leave at 5, drive up to Alton with my truck and my Ford D-Series truck, my Formula Ford in the back. I'd go and race, drive back down, and I'd get back at 9 o'clock on a Saturday night and get and cover and then take over my duties and then sort of work through the night and I'd get 3 or 4 hours sleep and then be on the next day, etc. But that's just what my life was like. I used to try and my big stress and panic was trying to find people to cover for me so I could do my championships and be bright up to do it. So anyway, when I got fully registered, having worked for a year, I then thought, I'm going to take it. I need to give motor racing a go full time. So I had a GP training scheme lined up, but I told the trainer, look, I want to take a year off. And that's when I managed to persuade the sponsor, Mike Cox from West Surrey Engineering, to buy the championship winning Formula 3 car that Stefan Johansson had, the Rout RT3 that Project 4 were running, Ron Dennis's team at the time. And by January 1981, I hung my stethoscope up and white coat and went racing full time. And it was an absolutely fairy tale year. I won my first ever Formula 3 race, the next three, won the championship. I mean, it had some ups and downs on the way. And by the end of that year, I was testing, within 10 months of hanging up my white coat, I was being invited to test Formula 1 cars for Williams, wow, Lotus and McLaren. So that was the as British Formula 3 champion.
Yeah.
So at that point, now I knew
you're never going to be.
I'm never going to be a doctor again.
Yeah.
And I was going to get to Formula 1. I was determined to.
Yeah. So let's because we need to space these cars out a bit. So let's do another one of your favourite cars.
Well, that's well timed again, actually, because I'm going to put my Mark 1 Golf GTI in here.
1600 or 1800?
1600.
Yeah.
1600 Golf GTI, black, with a little red rim around the grill.
I'll know it well.
When I was doing my medical job, say the one in Brighton, I was earning some money now, and well, not a lot, but you know, I was earning it, and clearly cars are my passion. I was racing. My first ever car I bought new was a Volkswagen Polo, which wasn't very macho, to be honest. Powder blue Polo. But anyway, it got me along. And then when I stopped racing and did Formula 3, I changed it for a Golf GTI. I bought a new Golf GTI from Crawley Volkswagen. And, you know, I love that car. It was, the original ones were left-hand drive, as you may recall.
Yeah.
Then they were three colours you could buy them in. It was black, silver, and red.
Yeah.
Mine was the black one, which I still think looks great.
Yeah,
car.
They do.
But you know, that
did they have 4-speed or 5-speed?
That was 5.
They were already 5.
Yeah, 5. I think the 4s were the left-hand.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Very early ones.
The tartan trim, golf ball gear. But you know, that car, I used to thrash the nuts off it. And I did things that, I drove it, you know what it's like. In those days, we were driving like you could never drive today on the public road. And thrashing up and down around the country, getting to Formula 3 races, Formula 3 tests. But you know, that car had 110 horsepower.
Yeah.
Which again, by today's standards, is not a lot. It wasn't 16 valve, they were 8 valve engines. But you know, the thing is, it only weighed 850 kilos. We didn't realise at the time, but that, I mean, they were just beautifully light.
Yeah.
And the performance of that car was great. Again, a bit like the Capri 3 litre, I really, you know, it impressed me. You know, even as a Formula 3 driver, it was fun to drive.
Yeah.
It was quite revvy, it was pretty smooth, the brakes stood up reasonably well. But the other thing that stands out about that, it had a great ride handling sort of balance, I felt, in that you could hustle it along British B roads and the wheel stayed in contact with the ground pretty well.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of digressing a bit onto other odd sort of bees in my bonnet type things, but I do despair these days with a trend that we've gone down far too much with big size wheels, 18, 19 inch wheels, super low profile tyres. Mm. You know, we've lost a lot of compliance in cars.
Oh, absolutely.
And in the interest of looks, most people don't appreciate it. But honestly, I don't know what it had at the time. Was it 14 inch wheels probably or something?
13.
13 would it have been?
No, 14. I think you're right. Yeah. And a 185 section tyre.
Exactly, 185/70 or something. But you know, they had some compliance.
Yeah.
And you could hustle these cars along, really thrash them. Yes, they rolled a bit, but not a lot. But you had pretty consistent grip, nice steering, good handling. That was a great, it's a great car. I loved driving it. I drove it far too quickly on the public road, really. But did manage to survive it. Yeah. With it unscathed, and absolutely love the car. And again, it's a great example of a balanced car in its straight line performance and its handling and grip. It was all came together very well.
So going back to racing, you won the Formula 3 championship. You then won the Formula 2 championship, and then you found yourself a Formula 1 driver.
Yeah.
All within the course of 2 years.
Yeah, I was 1981 Formula 3 champion, 83 European Formula 2 champion, and then properly into Formula 1.
But you did a Formula 1 race in 83.
I did one race in September in 83.
Yeah.
But my first full season with Ram in 1984.
And was being a full-time Formula 1 driver all it was cracked up to be? I mean, obviously you were with a team with, I'm guessing, not a huge budget compared to those at the other end of the grid, but was it the dream come true, or was the reality somewhat different?
It was a little bit like my very start of motor racing, but extrapolated.
Yeah.
In that I was enormously pleased, thrilled to be in Formula One. And it was a real battle. You know, I fought to get the drive with Ram and raise the money for it and get in the car. And I knew, having been Formula 2 champion, although Ron Toranac wanted me to stay with the team in Formula 2 another year, that I couldn't do that.
Yeah.
I had to somehow, by hook or by crook, find a way to get into Formula 1, which I did with Ram. The car was pretty horrendous.
Yeah.
And something that that people would have no real concept of today is the chasm of performance gap that there was between the front of the grid and the back in those era. We're talking the turbo era, really.
Yeah, of course.
You know, back in 1984. And you had the front of the grid with sort of McLaren, Tag Porsche, Lauda, Prost in the McLarens. You had, and then me in the, at the back with Philippe Allier, my teammate, in the Ram. There was Mauro Boli in the Spirit. And we were running pretty shitty cars, really. With the Hart turbo engine, which we had probably 200 horsepower, 300 horsepower less than McLaren. The difference in lap time, if anybody just go back and look through the grids from racing in that time, sort of 84, 85, you're looking like 10 seconds gap from the front to the back. I mean, now it's sort of 2 seconds.
Yeah.
I mean, however bad you might think the back of the field is today, it was amazingly close.
And presumably you not only had this big, you had a horsepower deficit, and presumably the way that horsepower delivered, I'm presuming the Hart engine was fairly sort of meat and two veg when it came to power delivery.
The main thing is the fragility of the engines.
Yeah.
The Hart engine was very fragile. Philippe Allier and I, my teammate, we were more often than not end up sharing a car in qualifying, because probably one of our engines would go on the first run.
Yeah.
So we then have to jump in one car and both jump in and do a couple of laps in one car. You know, you take your seat out, jump in it, and just try and, you know, and the cars were, I mean, they weren't stiff. They were, I tell you, the chassis moved and twisted and around so much. I mean, mine was an aluminium chassis.
I was going to say, so carbon hadn't reached that end of the grid by then?
No, it had, Alio's car had a carbon top to it, which is a bit of a halfway house, but not really. And it was that bad, for example, that going through Eau Rouge in these things, the chassis would be twisting so much that the steering would lock because of the pinching of the rack. So you'd literally have to set the steering angle you wanted at the bottom of Eau Rouge and it would be fixed. You don't know where you're going to change it for about 2 seconds as it dipped out and the low G built up at the bottom. And once it had gone through that, so you weren't going to put any opposite lock on.
No.
And then
so it was Carl's going to go
later,
where it was going to go.
Carl was going to go where it's pointed, and then it was free off, and then you could grapple with it and hang on again. But it was so crude. And of course, there's nothing like data in these days. They were mechanical gearboxes.
Yeah.
And no data. The only bit of data you had really was a lap time.
Did you worry about hurting yourself in these things?
No.
Not at all.
No. You would. Actually, remarkably, it was sort of that era, I think, was pretty sad. I mean, Johnny Cecotto broke his legs badly at Brands Hatch. I think that was 84 or 85. I can't quite remember. One of the two. But funnily enough, despite
I suppose
the fact,
it had stopped, hadn't it? Well, to an extent. You think of the 70s.
But despite the fact these cars were, I mean, the decent ones with BMW engines and, you know, the Ferrari turbos and the Renault turbos, they had 800-900 pushing 1,000 in qualifying.
Yeah.
I mean, my Zach speed was a similar thing. But I mean, I never had a big accident at Zach speed. I don't know quite know why we didn't, because they were desperately crude. We had, you know, you're putting on qualifying tyres and turning the power up from 750 horsepower to 1,000 for qualifying.
Yeah.
And you went out and wrestled with this Tiger for, you know, for kind of a lap, hoping to God that the engine didn't shit itself on the way around the lap, which it had a fair old chance of doing.
Yeah.
It was just, the crudeness of it was immense compared to how refined everything is now.
Let's do another car, another favourite car.
Right, let's go on to, we'll go on to another road car. So I've got a couple of race cars, and I've got three road, and the next road car. So we did the Golf GTI, and this is a car that I drove a lot in the early 90s when I joined McLaren after stopping racing in Formula One. I joined McLaren as their test driver. So I was test driver alongside Senna and Berger, who were the regular race drivers. But also at that time, I was the test driver for the McLaren F1 road car.
Yes.
You'll remember well.
Which I remember very well, yes.
Which was, again, another kind of animal, really. An amazing animal, but another animal. And working closely with Gordon Murray, and then on latterly on the development with James Robinson. But the benchmark car that we used for the McLaren F1 in that Gordon had identified, quite rightly, was the Honda NSX.
Yes.
And I did a lot of driving a Honda NSX, introduced to it as through that program, but also then because subsequently we did some driving events when I was then getting involved in my business with the Honda NSX. And I love the Honda NSX.
Yeah.
For all sorts of reasons. I loved the boldness of Honda. I had huge admiration, and still do, with Honda for engineering excellence. And here was Honda's first attempt to rival Ferrari, who at the time probably had the 308 or 328 or something. You might have a better memory.
It was a 348. It was a terrible car.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And here Honda had come along and produced a car that was so much superior.
It was.
To the Ferrari.
Yeah.
With their first attempt.
Yes.
And not only was it was the driving experience superior, but the engineering was so much superior. You know, you had a wonderful, the beautiful aluminium castings, the wishbones on it. The engine was, it wasn't, I think it's 276 horsepower from memory.
It wasn't. Yeah, until the 3.2 came in, you're absolutely right.
It wasn't hugely powerful.
No.
But it sung round to about 8,000 revs. It had the VTEC. So, you know, you had that sort of intake deepening.
It was great.
At sort of 6,500. And again, the suspension was progressive. Mm. It was supple.
Yeah.
Without power steering, it was a bit heavy on the steering, but with power steering, it was lovely. But even without it, it was fine. But, you know, as a fully sort of harmonized car between engine sweetness, lovely gearbox, good grip, supple chassis, brakes, it all worked as a package together beautifully. In a bit of a similar concept to the Golf GTI.
Yeah.
It was a real, it's a pleasure to drive. And to be honest, it was a much more of a pleasure to drive than the McLaren F1. I'd often go back to go and say, look, you know, we're miles away still. You know, the ride handling of the, and the stability of the NSX was, frankly, it was always vastly better than the McLaren F1. You know, the McLaren F1 just dazzled with awesome power and an incredible sound that, to be honest, people were so overwhelmed by that a lot of the time you just didn't. Yeah, and obviously it had big tyres on it, it had a load of grip, but its handling was not as nice, anything like as nice as the NSX.
You probably won't remember taking me around the old Nürburgring in an F1.
Did I take you around the old Nürburgring?
You took me around the old Nürburgring in an F1, in the wet, and it had been 11 years since you'd last been there.
God.
You don't remember it, I'll never forget it.
It
was because you were at that stage where you were still quite confident but not entirely sure which way the track went. And, you know, well, you know better than anybody in the world probably that F1s weren't the easiest things to drive in the wet. It is seared on my memory.
Yeah, I bet it is. God, that does. It does coming back to me a bit now, yeah. The McLaren F1.
They wouldn't let us on because it didn't have a number, because you were doing client rides around the new circuit, and they wouldn't let us on because it didn't have. They were letting coaches on, things like that, but we didn't have a number plate on the front of it, so they wouldn't let us on. So we had to go back, literally unscrew the number plate from some car in the car park, stick it on, and then we were fine.
To sort of satisfy, okay. I can totally imagine that, Jesus, that must have been you must have needed to have either a lot of confidence or just a. Everything crossed.
I think I needed a stiff drink after that.
I bet you did. Well, I'm glad anyway. I'm glad we survived it unscathed.
We did.
You know, the other thing about the NSX, that I still think the looks of it. I think a lovely looking car.
It's a great looking car
and a distinctive looking car.
Yeah.
Which is in today's world, it's so homogenous, isn't it? You know, the distinctive looking cars are. Oh, do you know we've just had you know, some amazing years of
very lucky to have
very lucky to be in this sort of time, I think, Andrew.
So back to Formula One. Your career in Formula One lasted from 83 to 89?
Correct.
I think. And you never got in a front running car?
No, I'd always I didn't. I know, I was sort of midfield cars. Yeah, in truth, it was probably as good as I deserved. But I thought I was looking good in my last year of Formula One when I was with Tyrrell. Actually, that was quite interesting because I had Michele Alboreto as my teammate.
Yeah.
We started, and the chief engineer was, or the designer was Harvey Postlethwaite. There was an aerodynamicist called Jean-Claude Miggio,
mm-hmm.
who came from Ferrari, who was very good. So they built this quite radical car, the 018 Tyrrell. And it was radical, it had a sort of monoshock front. Basically, the front wheels went up and down together pretty much. With slight movement with a thing called Belleville washers that the rocker moved. But anyway, the season started, and Tyrrell being Tyrrell, you know, there was only one car of the new ones.
Yeah.
And actually, Michele and I went to the first Grand Prix at Rio, both with the old 17 that was a dog of a car, so I don't think we qualified probably or any just. And then I think it was the second Grand Prix, or maybe it was the third, I think it's the second Grand Prix, it was Imola. And Michele, particularly because he's Italian, had the new car,
which,
you know, I couldn't argue with that shit, he's a Ferrari race winner, you know.
Yeah.
So Michele had the old car, had the new car, and I was in the old one again. Anyway. Basically, at the end of it, I qualified 25th with the old car. Michele didn't qualify. He didn't like the new car at all. He found it, you know, oversteery and said it's not working, and I mean it was a grim weekend, because Ken Tyrrell and Harvey Postlethwaite and Migeot, you can imagine he's got Harvey Postlethwaite, he's got Migeot, he's really invested in trying to make a big step.
Yeah.
And he's got Alboreto.
Yeah.
So he's got all of this sort of ex-Ferrari sort of performance prowess in it. And the first time the bloody thing runs, and it looks like it's worse than the old car, which was grim anyway. So everyone's sort of head in their hands. God, Jesus, what's
going on? Did you have any kind of data then?
Minimal.
Yeah.
So anyway, Kenny didn't qualify. And after qualifying, Ken said to me, he said, look, you know, do you want to run the new car? He said, look, you know, we've clearly need to put some miles on it. And I said, yeah, fine, we'll run the new car. And I thought the old one's wrong, you know. And I was mystified as to why the new one, it looked so much, why it was so bad. So, and then in those days, we used to have a 30-minute warm-up on Sunday morning. So I jumped in it the first time, for Sunday morning. And so I drove around, and I did two or three laps, and I came in and said, look, this thing's not oversteering. I said, it's very darty, but actually in the corners, it's understeering. We need to get some more front wing on this, you know, because this is... Anyway, in the court, I was just in and out throughout the warm up until I got the car to a complete, so it was balanced, and I felt good about it. And then, then we started the race. So I'm starting. Maybe I start from the back. I can't remember. I think I started from my grid position at 25th. Not that it really mattered whether it's 25th or 26th. And then on the warm up lap, the rear anti roll bar broke. So of course that's the last thing you wanted with it, understood. So I came in the pits, and whilst the other cars on the grid, and I started from the pit lane, and went out. Anyway, I settled in pretty quickly with the car, and it was actually going well. And kind of long story short, I finished sixth in the Grand Prix, first time out, got a point. And for the first time in my life, I was following up behind cars, slipstreaming them, overtaking them. Yeah. I was so excited after the race. I felt like a racing driver. They've got a car that worked. And of course, Ken and Harvey and everybody was ecstatic about the fact that they'd come from wanting to put a noose around their neck to suddenly to in a day to this thing working. That was a good time. But then at the end, so Alboreto, I've got the upper hand of Alboreto, but then he left midway through the season for reasons I'm not quite sure. And so then I thought, well, now I'm in a great position because I've really asserted myself here.
Yeah.
And then Ken said, oh, we've got some Formula 3000 driver coming in. I thought that'd be all right, no experience. A chap called John Alesi. First race he did, Paul Ricard. I qualified 12th, he qualified 16th or something. And he came up to me afterwards and he said, God, he's amazing, how do you do that? Fantastic job for you in qualifying. I thought, shit, hang on a minute. This is your first Grand Prix and you're only about 3/10 behind me.
Yeah.
Why are you so impressed? Anyway, the next race he was one step behind and the rest of after that he was 3/10 ahead. And he's still a good friend, but I mean, basically he was quicker than I was. And that was the end of my Formula One career, basically. And so then I joined McLaren, back to your point, I joined McLaren as a test driver, thinking, well, look, I might, my career in terms of going any further is largely over. I might just luck in here if Senna or Berger have a problem, and I can get a race in the McLaren, which I was reserve driver for. That could just be that's my one way of potentially getting a result out of, getting in a top line car. But it didn't happen. But
yeah. So and you felt there was nothing you could do about Alesi. He was just
he's just quicker.
Yeah.
At the end of the day,
I find it very interesting that you. You obviously acknowledge that now, but you could see it at the time, because I think lots of drivers do sort of delude themselves and look to other factors and say, well, it's not me, it's because they can't look in the eye the fact that they're just not quite as quick as somebody else.
But yeah, I just think
that's what, exactly. That's kind of
it is, and I totally agree with you. I just think people do, it's better if you just be objective, and I try, but occasionally I'll be quicker, but generally, the guy was just quicker than me.
It's why I asked the data question, because I just wondered whether there was a way that you could actually incontrovertibly see that he was...
Well, we don't really have data then, of course, which is the other problem, which doesn't help with your driving, because when someone is 3/10 quicker around Monza or something, without data, all you do is try and brake later everywhere and turn in faster everywhere and get the power everywhere. Yeah. And clearly, 70% of the places, you're doing the wrong thing. Because, you know, so you've got to try and work it out for yourself, which in a way is good. But no, I recognise that. I recognise at that point. And, you know, before that, Arrows are talking to me, a number of teams are talking to me about the next year's drive, because clearly looking good against Alboreto, I was looking, I was recognised as a pretty good technical driver. And but no, it wasn't to be. But I'm fine with that, you know. As I said, overall, that's why I got the Formula One, because I was pretty quick, you know, pretty quick driver. But on top of that, I was very technical and I was very good at setting things up and getting the best out of the car.
Yeah.
Whereas you get other drivers that might be, frankly, quicker than me just jumping in something, but weren't as good as me at setting them up and getting the performance out of the car. And also just because I was so bloody motivated. You know, I would be at the track until, you know, I was first there, last out, you know, just trying to find that bit of performance. So. And so what that means is that ultimately I've always been very contented with what I did in motor racing, because I think I got the best out of the level of ability I had.
Yeah.
And that's all you can do in life.
Absolutely.
Whatever it is, you know, there's always going to be somebody who's going to do something better than you at some point, you know, and I think, you know, handling that and just being contented with it and getting your own balance of where you want to be on the scope of endeavour, achievement, happiness, time off, you know, relaxation is one of life's, you know, key challenges and objectives.
Let's do another race car, favourite car.
Well, let's do another race car. So now, again, fitting in quite nicely to the chronology here, so then I joined McLaren as test driver.
Yeah.
And the Tyrrell, well, the Tyrrell wasn't bad, but you know, it was no McLaren.
Yeah.
And at that time, Honda engines, 3.5 litre. And
10 or 12 cylinders then?
10 initially, 10, then 12. Yeah. So the MP45 was 10 cylinder, and then it went to the MP46 that was the 12. But the MP45, the V10 car, I loved.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the most beautiful looking Formula One cars. Clearly, anything McLaren, the quality of build, the quality of engineering, how everything worked, the gearbox, it was 6-speed, it was mechanical originally. Yeah. But driving a beautiful McLaren Formula One car with an 800 horsepower Honda 3.5 litre, normally aspirated V10, with a beautifully silky 6-speed mechanical box, it was one of the most glorious features. That was, to be honest, there aren't many times when I'd actually get huge pleasure from just driving a car, a race car. Normally, what gives you pleasure is the result you get out of it.
Yeah.
You know, you can have a car that you can put it on pole position and you think, this is magic. You get the same car and you're P7 on a grid or something and it feels shit.
Yeah.
So, you know, one's perception of pleasure is very much about the results you're getting out of it. But with the McLaren, clearly testing is you know, you're testing and identifying things and trying things. But with the McLaren, just driving that car, put a smile, you know, it was just a beautiful experience.
Yeah.
And the sound of it, the feel of it, the precision of it, the grip, the flow of it.
Wow.
I feel, again, very privileged to have driven that car. That's one of the all-time greats, isn't it? Yeah.
So let's talk a little about sports cars. Because some Formula One drivers, I mean, some Formula One drivers make wonderful sports car drivers. Guys like Jackie Yix go on to have incredible careers in sports cars. But because I guess Formula One is such a singular pursuit, because it's just you in the car and you don't have any teammates to hand over to or anything else, and the races are quite, it's a very different sort of discipline, isn't it? You know, racing a 956 at Le Mans compared to racing any Formula One car anywhere. Did you prefer one to the other? Did you feel particularly suited, or was it all just racing to you? And
I think it was really down to back to this point about the results.
Yeah.
In Formula One racing, I was in mediocre cars.
Yes.
And you had to get your pleasure from if I got, my highlights were 2 5th places really at Monaco.
Yes.
In 87 and 88.
Where having not that much power was less of a disadvantage.
Yeah. Exactly. My best result was 4th at Adelaide against Street Circus, and the lack of power wasn't such a disadvantage. Whereas in the Porsche in Group C, we were front running. Yeah. You know, we were up. It was, they were beautiful cars. They were challenging cars. The 956, as it was originally, and then the Porsche became the 962, when basically Porsche just angled the front wishbones forward to, so the front axle line was ahead of the pedals.
Yeah.
Didn't really make any difference to what was going to happen to your legs in an accident. You know, it was a compliant with the regulations.
Yeah.
But the 956 was better balanced than the 962. But it was a very physical car. You had a car. But I remember when Richard, who I was driving sports cars for with a little bit with the 924, which wasn't great. But when he said to Jan Lammers and I, look, I bought a 956. We're going Group C racing next year. This is at the end of 83. I thought, wow, what? It was as if a new Formula One team had bought a couple of Mercedes Formula One cars. We went down to Sindelfingen to pick up the car.
Yeah.
It was Richard Lloyd, Mick de Haas from Canon, Jan and me. And went down, and I remember looking at the car in awe. I mean, they were beautiful cars. And then sitting in it, you know, and here you've got a kind of, this is a race car, but it was almost like a road car. You've got an adjustable seat, you've got a nicely foam seat, you've got ignition key you put turned it.
Synchromesh gearbox.
Fine, the synchromesh gearbox. Yeah. You fired it up like a road car. But you know, at that time it had a 2.6 litre flat six engine, revving to 8.5. They weren't that heavy when they started off at 850 kilos again. So they were pretty light cars actually. Of course, they weren't very safe. It was aluminium, it wasn't even honeycomb, it was aluminium.
You had two accidents.
I had a number of big accidents with the things. A Spa in 85 was the bigger one that I've still got the legacy of a very arthritic foot and right knee from massive shunt there. But to drive the 956, they were very physical. You know, you had no power steering.
Yeah.
You had quite a lot of downforce. The brakes were steel brakes. Yeah. No power assistance on that.
Yeah.
You know, everything was heavy on the cars. And the gearbox too was quite heavy. Big synchromesh gearbox. Yeah. You couldn't rush it too much, but obviously you changed fairly quickly. And to cap it all, so whilst it was very physical, it was also hot because you've got an enclosed car.
No air conditioning.
You never got a single seater when you're driving, as the airflow all around just keeps you cool. But no air conditioning. You're just trying to put bigger bits of donkey dick in it to try and cool yourself down. So they were very physical. And I remember actually racing in 1983, must have been end of 82 he got it, in 83 at Nürburgring, the old circuit with the 956,
sharing
the
last ever 1000K race.
Last ever 1000K racing, sharing it with Keke Rosberg and Jan Lammers. We finished third. Great result. But I remember going up the long hill all the way up towards the first carousel, where it just meanders up.
Yes.
Bumps. And the bumps, the thing was being thrown around. Yeah. You know, really.
I can remember Derek talking about that.
The ground effect cars had outgrown that circuit, frankly. Yeah. And I remember the only way to drive it, you had to have the seat so close to the steering wheel that I used to put my hands up behind the back of the spokes and to cling on to the spokes and almost put my chest on the wheel and steer with my chest to try and stop it. You couldn't just hold it like a normal steering wheel. You'd get the steering wheel flung out and you sort of pulled the steering wheel into your body and just sort of guided it up like that. But they were, you know, that was a fantastic car and we had great results with it. And finishing second at Le Mans in 85 was an absolute highlight. Having led it for half the race, I think I drove for 14 hours that race.
Blimey.
I do think it's one of my best drives actually, because
sharing with James Weaver
James Weaver and Richard Lloyd. Richard did a few token runs, but not very much. And obviously, Le Patron did the final across the line, which was great.
And fair enough, his car.
James wasn't so keen on driving it at night, so I mean, I ended up doing the majority more of the run, and that was so essentially it was two drivers, of which I did 14 hours. Keith Green was team manager, he was brilliant, and great fun too. And just being right at the front of a race like Le Mans was great. And the other one that stands out as a real highlight was Brands Hatch 1000K race. Which we won in 84 with Jan Lammers. And that was a time when, you know, again, my technical sort of bent was, all right, going to Brands Hatch, No real straights at Brands Grand Prix circuit.
Yeah.
You know, lots of sweeping corners. The big rear wing on a 956 means you can get loads of rear downforce, but of course the limiting factor, you had to get to keep the car balanced or it's pointless, was getting enough front grip.
Yeah.
So I had the idea of putting an extra front wing on top of the nose of the 956, a supplementary single-seater style front wing. And the good thing with Richard Lloyd and the team is that they were up for having a go in Keith Green. Porsche factory looked down at it and said, God, you know, what are you doing, man? You know, you're compromising our wonderfully, designed car. And I said, well, this is what we're doing. So the first Friday practice, I went out and did a couple of laps and said, yeah, that's good. I said to Keith, look, take it off. Right, let's put the front wing on. And sure enough, it was oversteery. So I said, right, let's put some more rear wing on, balanced. Right, let's put some more angle of the front wing on. And I'd go to keep cranking up the front wing. At least I'd be out once past the pits in like this until we got the thing flying because we're just carrying more downforce because we could balance it. Put it on pole by nearly a second and we won the race at a canter despite losing fifth gear, I think, the last hour or something. So that was a very satisfying example of frankly, me having an idea of the team doing a great job preparing the car, but in terms of the performance margin, of me having the idea of the front wing, me recognising it's going to be important, the team accepting having the confidence to try it out, and the creativity to try it out, and then we made the best use of it in the race and got the result out of it. And that sort of approach is probably what is probably typifies what the strengths that I had as a driver on it.
Was that also the year you didn't start Le Mans because you had an accident in practice?
Yes, that was a lot later actually. That was 90. One apart from McLaren, the Porsche 956 goes down as the fifth of one of my six cars.
Ah, okay, fine.
I should just
fine.
Sorry, I've
sorry. No, that's fine. So that counts. That's what.
So
that's
that counts.
Why,
so okay. It was the most magnificent car. It looked lovely.
Yeah.
And also, I do think
it's prettier than 962.
You can't
isn't
have
it?
A prettier than 962. Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't have a. You can't really have a top car without it looking good.
Yeah.
I think even road cars now.
Yeah.
I don't think there hasn't really been a successful road car that's not looked good.
No, I think you're probably right.
So it looked good. It was super exciting. The amazement and the thrill, as say, of being able to drive this car was immense. The results we got with it, the enjoyment with the team, I have to say, Richard Lloyd, John Britton, and Keith Green. So all of that is why that car is and. The other thing is, a 956 will always be, I mean, I should have bloody well bought one at the time, but we never do we? Because it'll be an absolute legendary car.
Absolutely, sure. Yeah.
The distinctive sound, I can always, one of those noises you can recognise, I could hear half a second of a 956.
Yeah, it was a 956.
956.
Yeah.
That sort of. So anyway, that's car number five.
Lovely. I do just want to mention that Le Mans, because I just remember you telling me a story about it once. Because didn't the car get airborne?
Yes, it did. This was in 90 or 91, I think. Is in practice, it was in a Joost Porsche 956, and they'd evolved considerably, 962 by then. But they had problems with rear suspensions breaking. And I was just pulling, this is pre-chicanes, or was it post-chicanes? No, I just pulling fifth gear, it's been about 180 miles an hour. I mean, we'd be doing sort of the gear for about 230. I mean, 231 was the most I ever saw of a 956 at Le Mans. And I just pulled fifth gear, about 180. And the car going down the Mulsanne suddenly swerved left. I mean, clearly something had broken. And the car, a girl's going to have a monster accident. And the car smashed in the barrier and you sort of cower down. And
do you instinctively, do you know, because you're going to have, do you get your hands off the steering wheel and your feet up or is there not time to think
about
that?
Take your thumbs out. I used to take my thumbs out of the steering wheel.
Yeah.
But just hold it. That was always my thing because you wanted to try and get some stability of your body, but not keep your thumbs in to get them whipped round. So I'd do that and the car I knew it was going to be a monster shunt, and sure enough, it was bang, crash, tumble, tumble, you know, all this to it. And there was, after a surprisingly short amount of banging and crashing, it all stopped and went still and quiet. And I thought, geez, that's, I thought, you know, I've just had a 180-mile accident and wasn't as bad. I thought, this is more like a 70-mile-an-hour accident. Anyway, then very rapidly, I could see in the next second why it was all still and quiet. And that's as the smoke and dust cleared. Far from being stationary, looking at a bit of Armco, I was in the air, about 10 feet up in the air, looking at the track disappearing from me at about 120 miles an hour. And the car feeling a very bad glider. And it had just been thrown up in the air, and I was going backwards in the air. So at that point, I thought, well, this is the Steve McQueen, Le Mans film, sort of in the trees, good night. And rather pathetically, I didn't even think of very much, just froze. Anyway, after what's an interminable amount of time flying like a very bad glider, it crashed down, thank God, on the track.
Yeah.
And it beat itself to death a bit more either side of the barrier until 400 yards after it all started, it finally came to a halt. And I was, there wasn't a wheel on the car really, it was, you know, just this smoking, hulking sort of chassis. And inevitably at that time, your body, your mind says, get out of the car before it catches fire.
Yeah.
You never know quite if the limbs are going to be in a method to do it. And later on, I did manage it, I got out. And I sort of looking back, and it was all very quick, and then splinters in, sort of jumped out. And I was looking back at this smoking wreck and just thinking how lucky I was. When suddenly I got a glancing blow on the head and a bouncing wheel and tire from my own accident caught me up and knocked me flat.
Really?
I staggered to the side of the road. I mean, shot, it was...
God, that could have killed you, couldn't it?
It lost most of its energy, but it's still going boing, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I staggered to the side of the track in disbelief at everything. Within half an hour, more than 10, 15 minutes, my feet were just throbbing and I just said, shit, I've broken my legs, I must have done. So back in the paddock, I got Nick Mason organised his plane to fly me back to that night to the UK. I didn't fancy a night in a French hospital trying to explain what was going on.
And, yeah.
So I arrived at the hospital at Cookfield. I got my Jill, my former wife, to pick me up and drove me to Cookfield. And at midnight, I'd organised the radiologist to have a look at it. And anyway, it turned out I hadn't broken legs, but just badly sprained. But anyway,
blimey.
Broken a thumb, that's all I did in the end. But it was, you know, I thought that was going to be the big one.
Last car, and then we'll talk about your life now.
Last car, I'm going to come right up to date. And that's that, it's just a great all-rounder of a car. BMW 330 Touring Diesel X-Drive.
Yeah.
I absolutely love it.
Ticks every box, doesn't it?
Ticks every box.
Yeah.
It's nice size. If you want to put stuff in it, you can. Generally, I think that estate cars look better than saloons. I like, you know, the styling. That BMW 6-cylinder diesel engine is phenomenal.
Yeah.
It's smooth. It's got loads of torque. God, who could believe diesels would come so far from the old sort of, I don't know, Perkins engines and Morris Oxfords and things.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a remarkable engine. 45 miles to the gallon.
Yeah.
The four-wheel drive from the X drive means you can punch out of T-junctions on wet roads. This is always the thing. It's not about snow or mud.
Yeah.
It's just about not having bloody, you know, when you've got loads of torque as you have with this thing. Traction lights flashing. And I think it's just a fun, and it's as quick as you need to be. In fact, they used to do a 335, but they've stopped doing the 335 now. But the 330 is not. It's got a 95% of it. But I just think it's a really great all-rounder, and I don't like hybrids. I'm a real skeptic of pretty much most things of them. They tick a box in terms of certain things, legislation. But the 330 diesel, that diesel engine is fantastic. The size is great, four-wheel drive. I think it's if you had one car in your life,
that's the one.
So, and it's not too big to park and to country lanes and that sort of stuff as well.
Yeah, that's a great car. It's a great car. So bringing things up to date, you stopped racing. You spent quite a bit of time doing some commentating after James had died. And I mean, you were never the sort of person who was going to sort of sit back and put your feet up. But then you discovered this whole other world, which is what you do to this day, in motorsport vision, all the circuits. Was that something that you'd always planned to do when you weren't racing anymore, or was it just something that you fell into?
I've never really planned very far ahead. When people talk to me now about saying, so what's your 5-year plan? I said, I've no idea. I've always looked at what my next steps, what the next direction is. Whether it's getting into Formula 1, whether it's Formula 3, Formula 2, sports car, you know, I'd look to see where is the next step and what is, and you know, you look to see what a sensible direction is and just focus on achieving the next step. And I've also been always concerned to know, to see when my career is evolving and changing, and when it's not, and that's not necessarily always going up. When, for example, I could see when Alesi was beating me,
yes,
like chances of, you know, we all know you're as good as a, you know, unless you're someone like Ricciardo, whose reputation can stave off a Norris assault,
yes,
McLaren. Generally, if you're a relative midfielder unproven, in the moment somebody starts beating you consistently, you know, you're kind of off the list. So I've always looked to see where I'm going to go next. So then I got myself into sports cars, and I got myself into in a McLaren test driver role. Yeah. You know, I steered that path through. Then I thought also, I got myself into media, as I thought maintaining my name and using my knowledge to the BBC would be good. So I opened the door on that one, and that was successful. And then I could see at that sort of time too that, you know, I needed to build a career, a business, outside of driving cars. And the business, I really, as a driver, my father didn't have a Beam. So the funding I had to raise to get through motor racing was always self-driven.
Yeah.
And a lot of getting sponsorship, one of the things that sponsors really did value, was doing things like driving days. You go and take a circuit and do hot laps basically around in the circuit, and people used to love it. So that was the thought for my first business, when I could see, and I could see my racing career dwindling. Of course, media in those days didn't pay much.
Yeah.
So hence starting my business at I thought, well, I'll do corporate motorsport events. This was early 90s. And I tried to get some track time up in the major circuits, Brands Hatch, Donington, Silverstone. Nobody would rent me any track time. They've got their own operations. And so I thought, okay, which is of course quite ironical. And so I found this disused old airfield called Bruntingthorpe. So I did a deal with the owners of that for £600 a day to rent it. And I got a PA and a mechanic and started. I was on the phone selling corporate driving events. I get in my car from Sussex, drive up, go and do the morning briefing, do hot laps of the day in the morning, do a F1, as I was commentating at the time, F1 sort of chat at lunchtime, do more hot laps in the afternoon, present the awards, drive back down to Sussex, and then spend the next day selling the next few events. And that's how the business started in 1992. And by a commitment, as ever, is to do it well and understand what the market wanted. It grew and grew very rapidly. And then I needed to get my own venue, but the owners there didn't want to sell or lease. So, and then I found Bedford. I tried to buy the whole site, but again, didn't have any money to do that. So eventually did a lease deal, but then borrowed the money to build the circuit complex there at Bedford Autodrome. That went very well. Had a couple of small investors in on that, John Britton from Richard Lloyd's side and Peter Ogden. And then when the Brands Hatch Group of Circuits came up for sale, I've always been ambitious, you know, I've always sort of look, have a go.
Yeah.
So I said, look guys, I think this is a good thing to buy. So, and you know, to start with, we were nowhere near, we were bottom of a list of five of bidders, but we thought most of them were pretty dreamy. And eventually, not a long story, too long for now, but we bought that business. It was losing $3 million a year when we bought it, but within a year it turned it around by aggressive cost control and quality enhancement. yeah, so we built that, and of course Donington came along. We bought the Bedford freehold, but I love growing the business, and I love the whole. I love business. I love working with the employees and having ideas, ambition, leading the team, and motivating people. And I'm a pretty tough taskmaster. I'm probably renowned for that. But you know, I'm very much committed to the quality of things, and I like making things happen. You know, we've got the Donington Hall project, of course, down there now, and that's really exciting. I get more pleasure from running the business than I ever did racing.
Because, really?
Yeah. Every day, I mean, I'm in control. Every day I can make a difference or not. Whereas when you're racing as a driver, so many things are out of your hands, really. You know, to an extent, you know, at Tyrrell, it was kind of, as a driver, you do what you can in the car and racing and testing, and then you kind of expected to go off and keep fit for another 2 weeks and then come back and jump in the car again.
Yeah.
Whereas the business, you know, so you're just a bit helpless, and if the car wasn't very good, not much I can try and optimise a setup.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to suddenly increase its lift over drag for anything I'm going to do.
No.
Or bet more power out of the engine. So literally more of a passenger in it. Whereas, you know, I enjoy the ability and indeed kind of responsibility of trying to make more right decisions than wrong decisions.
Yeah.
And grow things, and I always get a lot of satisfaction from creating or developing and evolving circuits that people enjoy their motor racing on. You know, I love nothing more than wandering around a club racing paddock and just watching what's going on, looking at a few cars, chatting to some competitors.
Yeah.
I have enormous respect for people that, you know, our club racing competitors that are spending their money, not on golf, not on another holiday, but they're spending it on getting their cage room and whatever it is and going racing.
Yeah.
And I want to make their lives, I want to make that opportunity for them as pleasurable as I can. Yes, and, you know, clearly for financial reasons, but also for just the pleasure of it, really. You know, it's like making the venues nice. I'd rather try and get the venues to how I would like them to be first and foremost. And even if, you know, we might make a greater profit by not spending as much, but that's not the way I like to go and do it. But actually, in the end of the day, I think people will pay for quality and appreciate it. It drives the business. So I think they go hand in hand, really.
And is there any sense of, while you're doing this, which you undoubtedly have with all the circuits that you've acquired and modernised and updated, that you're also at the same time preserving Britain's motor racing heritage?
I think so, actually. Yes, I think that is important. That is really important. And even more important now than ever, probably. And I think... don't think about it very much, but I'd like to it'd be nice to leave a bit of a legacy of somebody who actually did not just keep the circuits going but transformed scruffy venues that people tolerated to being venues and developing them and that people really, really enjoyed. You know, we're all, you know, for the time any of us are here on this planet, you know, None of us matter very much, really, but it's quite nice. I do like achieving things.
Yeah.
So I get a lot of pleasure from that.
Great. Well, Donald, it's time to wrap this up. So the last thing we're going to do is you're going to tell us which of the six cars you would take for your last ever drive. But before that, you're going to tell us where it would be and with whom, if anyone. You could be all by yourself if you'd rather.
Right, well, the venue is going to be Brands Hatch Grand Prix Circuit, which is still, for a number of reasons, it is still the most amazing driving experience driving around the Grand Prix Circuit. It's Brands Hatch is where I had my first ever Gurner racing car on a racing school day there. I still remember looking over the day we bought the business, looking over the track, signing the contracts, almost in awe of what was the achievement.
Yeah.
And of course, I've had some great results there. My first ever Grand Prix, and winning the 1000K race.
Yeah.
So that's the venue. It will be on my own for the very obvious reason that it's a single seater.
Okay, fair enough.
And it is the McLaren MP45.
Yeah.
That which I say, I am making the assumption that when I'm having my last drive, I am magically able to be suddenly fit enough and thin enough to get fit, in the back.
And the car will be available.
We can make the rules. But then that's all part of the game, I'm sure. But to have the exquisite feeling of driving a McLaren MP45 around Brands Hatch Grand Prix circuit, I think is the closest to motor racing or motoring bliss one can have.
Brilliant. Jonathan Palmer, thank you very much.
Thank you.